Another round of ceasefire talks between Israel and Hamas begins in Qatar.
The high-level negotiations on Thursday include Israeli, Egyptian, and American spy chiefs and Qatar's prime minister.
Germany is thinking about slashing military assistance to Ukraine.
You're able to execute the mission that I think that Ukraine wants to be able to achieve, which is air superiority, right?
And want to go down the rabbit hole with Alice to Wonderland? We'll tell you how you can.
This rabbit is sort of our call to visitors to fall down the rabbit hole with us, come fall into Wonderland, and encounter some sort of magical things across the grounds.
Today is Friday, August 16th.
And this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Alexis Strope. A new round of Gaza ceasefire talks began in the Qatari capital Doha on Thursday afternoon, with Israel's spy chief joining his U.S. and Egyptian counterparts and Qatar's prime minister. Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman reports on the closed-door meeting.
Gaza's health ministry on Thursday said the death toll from 10 months of Israel's military offensive had crossed 40,000. In a statement, the Palestinian health ministry said another 40 people had been killed in the past 24 hours in the war-ravaged enclave. The grim milestone comes as a new round of ceasefire talks was underway in Qatar's capital, Doha, aimed at ending the bloody conflict and securing the release of more than 100 Israeli hostages held captive by Hamas militants in Gaza.
This week, we expect these talks to move forward as planned.
A ceasefire outlined in the spring by U.S. President Joe Biden would pause fighting and begin the return of the hostages, but both sides have blamed the other for failing to reach an agreement. Palestinian Mohammed An-Najjar said she wished those meeting in Qatar would look upon her with mercy. She said she wished for a ceasefire today, before tomorrow. In Tel Aviv, relatives of those held hostage demanded the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reach a deal returning the captives. Yotam Cohen's brother Nimrod is among the hostages. His message to the negotiating team in Qatar was that if they could not bring home the captives, that they should not return to Israel. He said they have no reason to come home empty-handed. The high-level negotiations on Thursday include Israeli, Egyptian, and American spy chiefs and Qatar's prime minister. And the discussions are underway under the shadow of even wider regional tensions. U.S. warships, submarines, and warplanes have been dispatched to the region to defend Israel and deter a potential Iranian attack. Iran had vowed to retaliate after it blamed Israel for a blast that killed a top Hamas figure in the Iranian capital. Three senior Iranian officials have said that only a ceasefire deal in Gaza would hold Iran back from direct retaliation against Israel.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman.
So let's dig in a bit on this. Joining us now to talk about the current round of ceasefire talks and the hostages is Boaz Atzili, a professor at the Department of Foreign Policy and Global Security at American University. So, they started this new round of ceasefire talks, and to me it just seems like we're stuck in this place that we're close, but we're never going to get to that point where they actually reach an agreement. Is that just me because I'm too close to it, or do you think that there's some truth to that?
I think that there's some truth to that. Yeah, it doesn't have to be this way. Like, it's very hard to guess exactly what is Yehiel Sinwar's position, and he's the one who's now basically getting all the decisions on the Hamas side. But it's very clear that the one who gets a decision on the Israeli side, that is Netanyahu, doesn't want to get to a deal. So I guess that's why we are stuck in the same place.
One of the main sticking points is Israel wants to keep a troop presence in Gaza and Hamas wants them to leave completely. Do you see any resolution to that point?
So there's a kind of like mismatch in the fact that this agreement is supposed to be with three stages, right? And I think Hamas agrees that in the first stage, there's still going to be some IDF troop remaining in the Gaza Strip. but he wants a guarantee that in the end of it, and by the third phase, there will be a complete withdrawal of IDF troops from Gaza, which is something that Israel has not been willing to commit to that.
Of course, the other thing that is still on the table are the hostages still being held in Gaza. I know you have a personal story about family members who were taken hostage. Can you share that with us?
Yes, sure. So my cousin Aviv Atzili and his wife Liat Atzili, who's also an American citizen, were both both disappeared from Kibbutz Nir Oz in the Gaza envelope on October 7. Liat eventually was released in the first hostage deal in November, the end of November. And one day after she was released, the family found out that from forensic evidence and stuff like that, that Aviv was actually killed on October 7, and his body was taken by Hamas to Gaza, as a bargaining chip, and that's where his body is still there. So Liat came back on November 29th. So their children at least got their mom back before they found out that they no longer have their dad.
So sorry. For the families that still hope that their family members are still alive, it's coming up on a year. It must be horrific.
Yeah, it is, and I'm very much involved with the attempts to try and to get to a deal and release of the hostages, and yeah, it's a trauma that keeps on playing on, and basically increasingly the families of hostages realize that the government of Israel, in particular the prime minister, does not really it's not much of a priority for him to bring back the hostages. He of course would say so, but it's really not a priority for him because his policies are determined by his political survival, basically, rather than by either the interests of bringing the hostages back or by Israel's national interests.
So I know that you're involved in an effort to help hostage families and to help get the hostages home. Can you tell us about that?
In part of a large group of hostage family members, this week we published a book in an effort to bring Netanyahu to sign the deal eventually. And that book includes 150 essays from members of families with hostages, but also from many experts, academic, former ministers, former heads of Mossad and Shin Bet, historians, etc., that point to Netanyahu and tell him that his legacy is at risk here, and he has been abandoning the hostages and the interests of Israel, and the only way he can kind of maybe a little bit change that legacy is by signing a deal now and bringing them back home. The name of the English name of the book, it's published both in English and Hebrew, is Benjamin Netanyahu's Dark Legacy, the Abandonment of Israeli office October 7th hostages.
Thank you so very much for the time and the perspective.
Sure.
Boaz Atzili, a professor at the Department of Foreign Policy and Global Security at American University.
After multiple delays, Ukraine announced this month that it has begun receiving U.S.-made F-16 fighter jets from its European allies. It's unclear just how many have been delivered, though about 20 are expected to arrive this year. Maria Pruce has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
The long-anticipated F-16 fighter jets have made it to Ukrainian skies. This video, published on August 4th by the Office of the President of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, serves as the first official confirmation of the delivery of F-16s to Ukraine. It's a big upgrade for Ukrainian aviation that until recently consisted only of Soviet-era warplanes. But F-16s won't be going up against advanced Russian systems, and General James Hacker, commander of U.S. Air Forces in Europe and Africa, says they won't change the battlefield calculus right away.
It's not going to be the golden BB or the golden bullet that all of a sudden, you know, they have F-16s and now they're going to go out and gain air superiority.
But retired U.S. Air Force Colonel Jeffrey Fisher says F-16s are highly capable aircraft, and in numbers, they will have an impact.
When it gets to be 12, 24, 36, then it really becomes a challenge, right? Because now you're actually you're able to execute the mission that I think that Ukraine wants to be able to achieve, which is air superiority, right? To be able to control the air over their own territory and then project air power over Russian forces.
Ukraine has been promised about 65 F-16s by Western allies, but another challenge is a shortage of trained Ukrainian pilots. Former F-16 pilot Dan Hampton says a possible solution might be inviting former Western F-16 pilots to fly for Ukraine.
That's where people like me come in. All right. If the bottlenecks are removed that allow us to come volunteer and help with Ukraine, then we can solve that problem.
For now, Ukrainian officials say the F-16s will play an important role in protecting Ukraine from Russian missiles and drone attacks. Maria Prus for VOA News, Washington.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Venezuela's opposition has rejected a suggestion of having another election. The proposal came from the leftist governments of Colombia and Brazil on Thursday, less than 3 weeks after the results in Venezuela's presidential election came into question when the main opposition coalition said it had proof that its candidate defeated President Nicolas Maduro.
Swedish health officials say they have identified the first case of Mpox a day after the World Health Organization declared the outbreaks in Africa to be a global emergency. In a statement Thursday, the Swedish Public Health Agency said the patient recently sought health care in Stockholm.
Hong Kong has welcomed the birth of its first locally born giant pandas. The theme park that houses them announced the birth in a statement Thursday, saying their mother has become the world's oldest first-time giant panda mother on record. Yang Yang, the mother, gave birth to twins, one male and one female, at Ocean Park just a day before she turned 19 years old.
In our continuing coverage of the 2024 presidential election, two reports released this week sound the alarm about an increase in efforts to disrupt the U.S. presidential election. They say information manipulation, political violence, and intimidation are on the rise. VOA's Veronica Valderas-Iglesias reports.
U.S. voters are increasingly being targeted by domestic actors who spread false information ahead of the 2024 presidential election. That's according to an election vulnerabilities report by the human rights group Freedom House. Kian Vestinson is the organization's senior research analyst. He spoke via Skype.
People here in the United States who are percolating conspiracy theories and misleading information about politics. Some 70% of Republicans and Republican-leaning voters have been captured by the conspiracy theory that the results of the 2020 presidential election were illegitimate. Now, ahead of 2024, we've seen that narrative already emerging and dominant.
There's also a rise in online intimidation and harassment of election officials, as well as political violence, the researcher notes.
We've seen political candidates experiencing direct attacks, including of course, the assassination attempt against former President Trump, hate speech and hate crimes against marginalized groups are on the rise.
While the voting infrastructure itself remains protected, cyber attacks are a source of concern, Westinson says.
The most vulnerable targets are campaigns and websites that provide people with information about the voting itself.
The FBI is currently investigating alleged Iranian hacking attempts against the Trump and Biden-Harris campaigns. A second report from the cybersecurity company Recorded Future finds an increase in malign influence operations by Iran, Russia, and China. They include the use of artificial intelligence to develop inauthentic articles that are then posted on fake news websites that look like mainstream media. Team lead, Sean Miner, via Skype.
To introduce bias within the content that is has a political slant or a political leaning in a specific direction based on the corresponding government's geopolitical objectives and how those geopolitical objectives correspond to their best interests with which candidate ends up winning the election.
How effective are those efforts?
At this point, we have no hard data to suggest that these operations have historically actually impacted the results of the election.
U.S. voters are nonetheless encouraged to remain vigilant and wary of grammatical or spelling mistakes found in the articles and website domains they come across, which could give away the impersonation attempt. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. Zimbabwe is hosting the annual summit of the 16-nation Southern African Development Community, or SADC, on Saturday. In the run-up to the event, human rights organizations have called on SADC to look at the country's human rights situation, including the arrests of opponents that started in mid-June. Steve Miller narrates this report by Columbus Mavunga.
Zimbabwe will host the annual summit of the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, Saturday in Harare, drawing leaders from the 16-nation bloc. Crews have repaired most of the main roads for the first time in years and even built some new ones. But on the ground and in the air, the police and military have intensified their presence in the run-up to the event. Tinase Chinapfukutwa of Zimbabwe's Lawyers for Human Rights says from mid-June until the present, there has been a wave of arrests of about 100 pro-democracy activists nationwide.
Those arrested have been subjected to prolonged detention and incarceration. And much more recently, we witnessed the arrests of four individuals at the Robert Gabriel Mugabe International Airport, who were forced off a plane and detained incommunicado without access to their lawyers. And they have also been, they were subjected to torture and other inhuman and degrading treatment.
The government-funded Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission said in a statement that it was investigating reports of activists' torture by security state agents. But Home Affairs Minister Kazembe Kazembe says the people were arrested for illegally protesting the long detention of activists arrested in June for reportedly holding an illegal meeting. He also says those detained plan to hold protests at the SADC venue.
It is clear that the organizers seek to provoke a heavy-handed response from government, which they assume would attract global attention. The attempts at rendering the country ungovernable would be met with befitting responses. Let those seeking to create an atmosphere of despondency among peace-loving citizens be warned that such antics will not be tolerated.
The rights organization Human Rights Watch has called on SADC leaders to look at the issues of human rights abuses by Zimbabwean authorities. Idris Nasa is a senior researcher in Human Rights Watch's Africa Division.
We are also saying that SADC leaders should speak out against this intensified crackdown on legitimate and peaceful activism. SADC should not be used as reason for Zimbabweans to live in fear, to be bludgeoned. We have seen in the last few days military tanks rolling on the streets of Harare in a very clear case of intimidation of the citizens.
During the summit, Zimbabwe will assume SADC's chairmanship for the first time since the 16-nation bloc became a development community in 1992. SADC aims to alleviate poverty and promote economic growth, good governance, and peace and security in the region. For Columbus Mavhunga, I'm Steve Miller, VOA News.
Scientists say data obtained by NASA's Robotic Insight Lander shows that an immense reservoir of liquid water resides deep under the surface of Mars, holding enough to potentially fill an ocean that would cover the entire surface of Earth's planetary neighbor. Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn has more.
New evidence of liquid water far below the surface on Mars is giving insight into what might have happened to Mars's ancient oceans. The recently released study uses data from NASA's Mars InSight lander.
And that tells us something about the water cycle of Mars.
Planetary scientist Vashon Wright is the study's lead author.
So Mars once had lakes, rivers, and possibly oceans on its surface. It has been, for the longest period of time, unclear where that water went after 3 billion years.
The lander, on the red planet since 2018, measured seismic data over 4 years. It examined how quakes shook the ground and determined what materials or substances were beneath the surface. Based on that, researchers found liquid water was most likely present about 7 to 12 miles below.
Our study findings do not say anything about whether there is or is not life on the planet. The only thing we can say is that a key ingredient for life as we know it and for habitability exists.
The study hypothesizes that the amount of water could have filled ancient oceans on Mars. Water would be a vital resource if humans ever established some sort of long-term settlement. But directly studying the water that deep beneath the surface is unlikely.
Drilling to get this water would be challenging. So on Earth, what you do is you often circulate fluids or muds to make drilling easier. You also need a lot of power or energy to make that drilling happen. And those two things need to either already be on Mars or we need to take them to Mars. And so that is a challenge in and of itself.
Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn.
And finally,
this rabbit is sort of our call to visitors to fall down the rabbit hole with us.
The New York Botanical Garden is enchanting visitors with exhibits inspired by Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which begins with a large topiary rabbit replete with a pocket watch.
The rabbit is the first thing that Alice encounters. She's sitting on a lazy Saturday with her sister outside in the grass, and all of a sudden she sees a rabbit with a pocket watch, right? And he's hopping and she follows him down the rabbit hole into Wonderland. And so for us, this rabbit is sort of our call to visitors to fall down the rabbit hole with us, come fall into Wonderland, and encounter some sort of magical things across the grounds.
That's Michaela Wright with the New York Botanical Garden. She says it's a tribute to the beloved stories of Alice and her journey through Wonderland.
Alice is such a curious little kid, and she sort of epitomizes that youthfulness when we're like asking a million questions. You know, any 8-year-old in your life is like, why? And we're sort of, I think one of the really resonant things about Alice in Wonderland is that into adulthood, sometimes we lose that sense of curiosity that we have as kids. And we really want this exhibition to be a call to us all to like channel that inner kid and sort of refocus our curiosity and say, wait a minute, maybe I kind of glazed over that tree, but why on earth does it have blue pine needles? That's crazy. How could a plant produce something like that? So yeah, really trying to just have us look a little bit longer than 1 second, you know, and sort of have that natural curiosity tapped into. And that's what we're hoping to do with this show.
The Wonderland Curious Nature Exhibition runs until October 27th.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, with Alexis Strope, I'm Scott Walterman.